It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, join this week's edition of Food Friday for some great advice and recipes we can use this weekend in our kitchens. First, extreme heat has covered huge parts of the United States for long stretches of time over the course of this summer. As of just yesterday, over 60 million people in the U.S. were under heat alerts, and that zone of high heat is expected to continue and expand over the weekend. Extreme heat can be lethal, but we don't always take it seriously. Why? Our next guest says that heat waves and global warming in general have a PR problem. He says that phrases like global warming and extreme heat don't capture the true scale and depth of destruction and threat to human and animal lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived in parts of the country with extreme heat? Have you seen them getting more extreme? Have you noticed summer's getting hotter, winter's getting warmer, summer nights not getting as cool? Join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked outside in high heat? What is that like? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff Goodell is a journalist and author. He's covered climate change for more than two decades. His new book is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. It's a New York Times bestseller. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, Jeff, you've been covering climate change, global warming for a couple decades now. This book, I think, is looking to turn up our sense of urgency a little bit. Can you talk about what you're trying to communicate here?
Well, you're exactly right. I am trying to turn up the urgency a little bit. And it came out of a personal experience of mine. You know, I've been writing about climate change for more than 10 years and, you know, thought a lot about heat in the sense of global warming, the general idea of a warming planet. But the immediacy and risk of it was not anything I really thought about until I took a walk of about 15 blocks on a 115 degree day in Phoenix, Arizona. And by the time I got to my destination at the other side of town, you know, I was feeling lightheaded and my heart was pounding. And I really realized that heat is a real immediate risk to people's lives. And the book was sort of born out of that experience. And I wanted to explore what heat means to us in the here and now as we live on this rapidly warming planet.
That reminds me that walk in Phoenix, you write that the human body, we have to think of it as a heat machine, and this delicate machine functions in a narrow area, kind of a Goldilocks zone, you say, of temperature conditions.
Yeah, I mean, we've evolved over the last, you know, several million years to in a relatively narrow band of temperature. You know, there's been, you know, hotter and colder times, but our body is tuned to a particular climate. And what's happening now is as things get hotter and hotter, we're moving out of that temperature bounds. And our body is really good at you know, regulating its temperature. We don't have to think about it, right? You don't have to remind yourself to keep your body temperature at 98.6 degrees. Our body just does it. And we have a mechanism which we use to maintain that internal body temperature, which is sweat. Everyone knows that. But there's at a certain point when either you don't sweat enough because you have become dehydrated, or if the temperature gets beyond what the sweat can deal with, that you get in trouble because your internal body temperature starts to rise. So it's basically about moving out of this zone of comfort that our body is so finely tuned over evolutionary time to deal with.
You talk about two different types of heat stroke. Neither of them sound good. It's a difficult read in some cases. Can you tell us about classic and exertional heat stroke and how they affect us?
Right. So the two different types of heat stroke, classic heat stroke is the simplest explanation is, you know, kind of what happens to a child if you leave them, or a person or an adult for that matter, but it's most often children that are sadly victims of this in a hot car. It is you're just in a hot environment and your body can't compensate for that heat, and your internal blood, internal body temperature rises and rises. You sweat as much as you want, but the heat is so extreme that that your body can't cool itself off. And that puts tremendous strain on the heart. different people have different kind of vulnerabilities to it, depending on how strong their heart is and things like that. But eventually, at a certain point, it will kill anyone. Exertional heat stroke is an entirely different thing. Exertional heat stroke is the kind of thing that happens to outdoor workers a lot, farm workers, delivery people, athletes, in fact, who are out, exerting themselves. When you're exercising, you're generating a lot of internal body heat that adds to the outside heat that you're experiencing from the hot day, and that can be extremely dangerous also for the same kinds of reasons, is that you're reaching a body temperature that you can no longer dissipate the heat from, and it's putting tremendous strain on your heart and circulatory system. And if you don't find relief, you're in big trouble.
We're talking to Jeff Goodell, author of the new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff, you live in Texas, a place known for heat, but Texas, parts of Texas are hitting records this year. Phoenix, were you talking about that walk, a hot place getting hotter. What is extreme heat looking like in places that were already pretty hot?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Austin right now, sitting here. It's 108 degrees. It's been over 102 degrees for, I think, 30 days now here. We're seeing these longer and longer heat waves that are hotter and hotter. And these are not really unexpected. These are within the kinds of climate that scientists have long been telling us that we are going to be experiencing as we continue to burn fossil fuels, which puts CO2 into the atmosphere, which is raising the temperatures on the planet. On an average, they're rising, but also it is creating these more extreme weather events. And this additional warmth causes these more extreme heat waves, like we're seeing here. We're seeing heat waves in unexpected places, the Pacific Northwest in 2021. Wisconsin is not known, of course, as a place where you've experienced a lot of extreme heat waves, but it is now in this sort of new climate, a place where I would not be surprised to see temperatures far beyond what you're used to at some point in the not so distant future. And so it's sort of the rising warmth of our planet has changed the sort of atmospheric dynamics so that these extreme events are much more common and much more unexpected.
You also visited Antarctica, not a place we think of as hot, but by Antarctic standards, it's had extreme heat, and that could have very dangerous effects for us. What did you see there?
Yeah, Antarctica is a place that's, long been thought of as a very cold, very stable place, where the larger warming of the planet has been very slow to reach for various reasons that were not worth going into. The Arctic to the north, has been warming basically four times faster than the rest of the planet, but Antarctica to the south has not been. And so there was a lot of thought that, Antarctica was a kind of stable exception to this sort of larger warming. But I went down there because I learned about some research some scientists were doing about the temperature changes in the ocean. And we talk about temperature changes, we're often talking about land temperature, which is where we live, and so that's what we think about. But ocean temperatures are really important. And what's happening in Antarctica is that the Southern Ocean, the temperature there, the average temperature there has risen just 1 degree Fahrenheit, which is hardly, you would think, hardly noticeable, but it has changed the melt rate of the bottom of the glaciers, where the glaciers meet the sea, and allowed the ocean water to get underneath these glaciers, and is destabilizing these enormous glaciers in Antarctica. And this has huge consequences for every kind of coastal city in the world, because as these big glaciers melt and collapse into the sea, they accelerate sea level rise. And so the point that I wanted, why I wanted to go there, is to show that even small changes in temperature in places like the Southern Ocean can have enormous implications.
We're talking to journalist Jeff Goodall about his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it's hot, do you rely on air conditioning, maybe for a medical condition or other risk factors for heat stroke? Do you worry as you watch these rising temperatures around the country? Have you experienced high heat, maybe working outside yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist Jeff Goodall about his new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What action, if any, do you want to see taken when it comes to climate change and fossil fuel emissions? Do you feel optimistic that we can deal with rising temperatures, or are you worried? Did you move here, maybe to Wisconsin, from a hot place at some point in your life, in part because of worries about the heat? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff, I want to talk about how we talk about heat. You write in the book, you know, hot is a euphemism for sexy. Warming sounds kind of nice. It's hard to take pictures of climate change as opposed, or extreme heat in particular, as opposed to the impact of a hurricane or an earthquake or something like that. Is part of the story a communications problem here?
Yeah, it is, and it's a deep and complex communications problem. I mean, you know, things, other kind of climate related, you know, events like, you know, hurricanes, droughts, all those kinds of things are very easy to visualize. We see them, we know, you know, we can tell looking out our window if the wind is blowing 20 miles an hour or 120 miles an hour. It looks very different. You know, roofs are flying off houses at 120 miles an hour. Heat, you know, I'm looking out my window in Austin right now and I can't tell if it's 70 degrees out there or 120 degrees. It looks exactly the same. So there's no visual, you know, messaging that helps us understand the risks of heat. It's only when, like I did on my walk in Phoenix, you go out and your heart starts pounding and you start feeling lightheaded and you think, oh my gosh, this is dangerous. I'm in trouble. And so, and this is, you know, part of the problem with the way we talk about global warming. Global warming just sounds like better beach weather. It doesn't sound like very worrisome at all. So, and people talk about, scientists talk about, you know, 2 degrees of warming. And to most people, 2 degrees of warming just sounds like nothing. It's like the difference between a 78 degree day and an 80 degree day. It doesn't sound worrisome at all. So there's a lot of problems in how we have come to understand and calculate the sort of risks of this warming that we're experiencing.
You also focus on who is hardest hit by extreme heat. If you can afford in a hot place like Texas or Phoenix, to have air conditioning and stay inside it, it may not feel like a big deal. But you look at migrant workers who work in fields or people who live in Chennai, India, in shacks. Talk about how the impacts are unevenly distributed.
Yeah, in the book, I talk about a kind of bright line between the cooled and the damned, meaning people who have access to refuge on hot days and in hot weather, who are privileged enough not to have to work outdoors and experience the heat, and who don't have to make a choice between, you know, being productive in their jobs and, you know, risking their lives to do it. You know, the people who are most, you know, heat is predatory. It goes after people who are, you know, have weaker hearts, who have poor circulatory systems, who are forced to work outside. I mean, I'm here in Texas and I look at these workers outside, you know, in the middle of, on a day like today, 106 degrees, who are working on the rooftops, putting on new roofs and stuff. And the kind of what the risks that they're dealing with in doing that kind of thing. Farm workers too. I write about the death of a farm worker in Oregon, due to the fact that he was out in a field working on an extremely hot day. He knew he was at risk. He knew the dangers of extreme heat, but he also knew that if he took a shade break, started and took breaks to drink water, he would likely be fired. And there's no labor laws protecting at that time in Oregon. There have been some passed now, but there were no laws protecting the workers from these extreme heat conditions, insisting on breaks for 10 minutes every hour or something like that. So there's a real, you know, it's really easy to say, oh yeah, just get everybody air conditioning and it'll be fine. But that's not the way the real world is going to work.
Talking to Jeff Goodell about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Jeff, I want to talk about some solutions you look at in the book. And on the communications front, things like naming our heat waves and other communications efforts to communicate the impact of these extreme events. Where do you see success stories?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, this question about kind of just getting smart about the risk of heat and understanding how dangerous it is, understanding why dry heat is less dangerous than wet heat, for example, because of the wet heat, it's more difficult for your sweat to evaporate. Getting better with a kind of media messaging and public health messaging. I mean, think about what happens when you have a tornado coming through, or when you have, if you live on the coast, a hurricane. The government has all kinds of ranking systems, you know, a category one, category two, category three. It tells you immediately a lot about the wind speed, about the risks. You have a lot of information about evacuation routes. You have a lot of, everybody knows kind of what to do. It's drilled into their heads in a very clear way. The entire government mobilizes around keeping people safe. That does not happen during heat waves. At most, you might get some kind of alert on your phone, but there's no sense of what to do, where to go, how dangerous is it? Is it a really bad heat wave? Is it not? So I think there can be a lot done just in the simple sense of preparing and educating people for what to do during heat waves. And then there's things like, of course, cutting fossil fuel consumption, because that's what's driving the heat. Building cities with more green spaces, more nature in cities, more shade, more refuge for people. Here in Austin, we have like a public park with a big pool, a natural spring in it that is a haven during hot days. Things like that that allow people access to public spaces that are cooler during hot weather.
Do you see widespread efforts to do that in communities to take these cities that are already heat islands in some ways, more so as climate change heats them up more, to combat that heat island phenomenon?
Yeah, you know, there's beginning to be efforts, but I mean, let's be frank. I mean, it's, you know, the cities are built over many decades, if not centuries. It's going to take a long time to refashion a place like Phoenix or a place like Austin, and you know, it's going to take a long time to change the sort of physical geography of these kinds of places. It's going to take a long time for people to figure out ways to get more air conditioning to people who can't afford it. And you know, in certain ways, places like some of the studies have shown, the mortality studies of heat waves have shown that places like Madison and northern cities, who really are not equipped to deal with heat at all, who don't, people don't think about heat waves there. They don't have, just like when the ice storm hit Texas. If you live in Wisconsin, you know how to deal with an ice storm. An ice storm hit Texas, you know, 2 years ago when I was here, and people just freaked out. They had no idea what to do. And so there's a strong case to be made that northern cities are sort of, people who live in northern cities are kind of more at risk from these sort of freakish and extreme and increasingly hot weather patterns that are going to be emerging in the future than places in heat-savvy cities like Austin. Even though the temperatures and stuff might be higher, at least there's a higher level of knowledge of what to do during these kinds of extreme conditions.
You talked to one expert in one of your visits to Phoenix, I think it was, who was warning of, you know, a Katrina-level heat event if one of these heat waves coincides with a power outage. What are the worst-case scenarios people are worried about?
Well, they're pretty horrific. You know, one of the things about air conditioning is, you know, everyone thinks that, you know, I have air conditioning, I don't have to worry about any of this. Whatever the temperature is, I'll just crank up my AC and it's all fine. But that works well as long as the grid is up and stable. During extreme heat events, the grid load is very, very high. We're feeling that in Texas right now. Yesterday, I think, was a record-breaking demand on the Texas grid. Thank God it was stable. But during these kinds of events, the grid is is more vulnerable to blackouts. And if you have a massive blackout, which has happened, it happened here in Texas in the winter. If you had a 2 or 3 day blackout, you could have massive casualties. I mean, one study that I cited in my book talks about 80,000 people dying in a city like Phoenix over if there was a blackout that lasted more than 36 hours. Because what happens is, we've built, especially in these hot cities, we've built these buildings with sealed windows. You can't open the windows. They work fine if there is air conditioning, but if the air conditioning fails and the power fails, then they become convection ovens and there's nowhere to go. And it's a kind of horrific scenario.
Did you, in our last minute or so, Jeff, come out of this long project leading to The Heat Will Kill You First with any sense of optimism?
I do. I actually am some people have been critical of me of being sort of excessively optimistic, but I really do think that heat is really this these heat waves we're seeing is really driving home to millions of people that climate change is not a far off distant event. It's really happening fast. It's happening now. Our lives are at stake, and that we can make changes to do things differently. We can get our energy from a different place. We can build cities in different ways. We can grow food in different ways. There's a lot of possibility for kind of building a better world, but we have to be engaged. We have to understand the risks that we face, and we have to get politically involved because this is not just about technology and culture. This is also about politics.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jeff Goodell, journalist and author. He talked to us about his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Coming up after the news, join in on this week's edition of Food Friday. Love to hear from you if you are a picky eater. Is there a food that you once avoided and learned to like? If so, how did you do it? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a single U.S. senator is holding up hundreds of military promotions and leadership confirmations. We'll find out why and what effects the holds are having on national defense and preparedness. Now it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We've all probably shared a meal with a picky eater before. Maybe it was one of your kids who didn't want to eat the veggies. Maybe it was a friend who sticks to what they like. Maybe it's you sometimes. There's no shame in being a picky eater. Everybody has different experiences with food. There's some evidence our food preferences could be linked to our genes, even. Our next guest is here to help us cook for the picky eaters in our lives and find new ways to prepare foods that we think we don't like. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you cook for picky eaters in your life? Have you found tricks to mask the flavor of some foods or sneak things into a dish? Are there things that you used to not like, but you found a way to like them? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's the author of 3 cookbooks. The latest is called Smitten Kitchen Keepers, New Classics for Your Forever Files. She used to write guest articles, by the way, for Bon Appetit magazine called Picky Eaters Club. Deb, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I think Deb Perlman, if she cooks a meal, everybody's going to like it. Nobody's going to be picky about this, but the pickiness is coming from inside the house, Deb. I guess your kids sometimes are picky, right?
It's like you knew. yeah, the picky eaters are inside the house. I actually feel like, a recipe writer, a cookbook author that has really picky kids that don't want to eat any of her food, it's like hubris. Like, I had these children coming. I created them. I need them so they can keep me balanced.
What kinds of foods do you find you encounter prime pickiness on for your kids in particular?
Oh boy, I mean, where does one start? It could be. I mean, I guess spice is the obvious thing, which is really a bummer because although that's changing though, because my son is now he's turning 14. He's going into high school, and he definitely will put some hot sauce on his food. But it took a bunch of years, so I think they'll get there. But my younger one, if it has spice, if it's like, I don't know. I'm making eggplant parmesan tonight, and I feel like she's definitely not going to touch it, even though she likes all these flavors. You know, even if she's a little skeptical of eggplant. So it should be fun. I can keep you posted on how it goes, but I can probably guess.
And I've seen you in interviews, Deb, sometimes say that you're a closet picky eater for some things yourself.
I am such a closet picky eater. I don't know if it's just me or is it other people who do the food thing, but like, I wonder if in some way we're driven to it because we want things to be a certain way and they're not. I mean, that's kind of where you start. So I didn't really like eggplant parmesan growing up, but I didn't really understand like the breaded soggy thing. But then I started making it my own way and now I love it. So that's kind of, you know, where it comes from. And that's where it goes, I think, where you might start by thinking you don't like things and then you, you know, can get to the bottom of it by cooking through them.
Well, and that's, for me, eggplant is one of those foods. I never, like, hated it. I never liked it. I would never eat it by choice. If somebody made it, fine, I'll eat it. And then I started having it, you know, people would make it at State Fair and stuff, fry it up with some lemon and a little Parmesan. Mm. And that was, like, my gateway for eggplant. Mm-hmm. Now I like it all kinds of ways. Is that sometimes the key to bringing people into a new food, finding that one way they like it and then branching out from there?
Absolutely. And you have no idea when it's going to happen or where. So my advice would be, if you have picky eaters like coming from inside your house, the best thing you can do is try to keep making what you've always made and what you're craving, because you have no idea when it's going to be that they're going to like pick up a lamb chop off the table and go to town on it. And you won't find out if you just make the boring food that they say they like every day.
Now, there have been whole cookbooks, Deb, out there on the market that are basically like, yeah, trick your family into eating these foods that are good for them, even though they don't like them. And, you know, how to disguise vegetables in cake or whatever. What do you think about that notion?
I'm generally opposed. I kind of feel like if I'm sticking like spinach in a brownie, I'm probably teaching the kids to hate both spinach and brownies, which seems like a crime in and of itself. I think that people will come around to it eventually, but they might just need to try it a few ways. I also think, I don't know, I've never been able to articulate it well, but I feel like there's this whole other psychology at home where when you come home, you want your mom or your dad to make the food the way you like it. And the disappointment is less that the food isn't what you want, but more that the people who are supposed to cater to your every whim and beck and call didn't do it. I just feel like it's just a theory, but I just think it comes out more in the safety of our own home. For example, let's say you go home every year for Thanksgiving and your mom always makes turkey your favorite way and you love the way she makes turkey. And one year you come home and she's made it a completely different way. Would you not feel a little affronted? You knew I liked it this way and you made it this other way. I sometimes feel like that's what I'm doing with at the dinner table, this betrayal.
It's Food Friday, and we're talking to Deb Pearlman from the cooking site Smitten Kitchen, author of books of the same title. We're talking about picky eating, ways to cook to overcome pickiness amongst our kids, even amongst ourselves. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to admit, are you now or have you ever been a picky eater yourself? Did you find ways to overcome it and try new stuff that you didn't think you liked originally? Have you dealt with this with your own kids at home? Have you found ways to get them to try that new thing? Maybe even eventually to like that new thing. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We got a note from our producer, Rochelle, who says, I'd love to hear about olives. I really want to be a person who loves olives. I travel once a year. Probably an urban myth that if you try them, you like 17 times, you'll like them. Okay, no, so this, I bring this up, Deb, because this was me. I used to hate olives. Mm-hmm. I had some housemates who liked some green olives on pizza with other good stuff. I ate it that way. Again, this was my gateway in olives. Now I love them. I'll just snack on olives of various shapes and sizes. Do you have thoughts on how somebody like Rochelle, for some reason, wants to acquire an olive taste, how she could do it?
You know, that's a tricky one because I have members of my family, people I know, and they just don't like it. I guess my question is it the brininess? Like, do you also dislike pickles or is it olives in particular? Because I don't think I thought I was an olive person growing up, and I still like my stomach actually turns by the black canned ones. I just don't like them. There's something squishy about them. I'm sorry. I should speak more maturely. I don't mean to yuck anyone's yum. But I love those dark green ones that are a little, they almost taste more like vegetables to me. And I love, you know, there's different ones. And I like a good Kalamata one. And I also, there are these little black cured ones. They go by a couple different names. I think they're like Gaeta olives. And I think they're incredibly salty. But you mince them up and they make a pasta sauce just pop off. So I think definitely trying a bunch of different varieties can help. But I also think it's okay. Like, or maybe sometimes it becomes something like I have this chicken that I love to make with olives and lemon and garlic and thyme, and it comes together so well. So sometimes the gateway is just it being in a dish that you love and it carries it, and you can kind of see where what it does there.
Awesome. It's also okay to just not like olives, I think. I like
it's
them
okay.
now, though.
You guys, I don't like beets, okay? So it's fine. It's just, it's never going to happen. It's okay. I've made peace with it. I hope every, I don't know that the internet has. I'm going to get some emails.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Cassie is with us in Lake Mills. Cassie, hi.
Hi. I just have a really quick story. I have two girls, and they're grown now. But they were always very picky eaters. And I did tend to make excuses when there were other people around and say, oh, well, they're girls. They eat like birds. And I would feed them really what they like. But one time, I will never forget this, my one daughter would not touch tomatoes, didn't like anything with tomatoes. She would pick them out of any salad or anything. And we were at my dad and his wife's house, and she made BLTs. It was a hot summer day, and big chunks, thick slices of tomatoes. And if Brianna didn't just eat those sandwiches, I think she had two. So later I asked her, I said, well, what is with you? You don't like tomatoes. I can't believe you ate that. I told Grace how wonderful it was. And she said, well, I didn't want to be rude. And actually, it was so good.
So I guess the big question, Cassie, is then did she eat tomatoes henceforth?
Yeah. Oh, she eats spaghetti, all kinds of pasta dishes with tomatoes. Yep. Yep, all the time.
Cassie, thanks for the call. Deb, I wonder if the secret there was the B. Like, can you make any food better with a little bacon on top of it?
I mean, I generally feel that this is a time-honored tradition. You can put some bacon in a broccoli salad. You can put bacon on your green beans, and suddenly everyone's a green bean fan. It definitely works. It's salt. And if you don't eat bacon, I mean, you could – I love putting, like, crushed salted pistachios. There are other things, I'd say olives, but I know they're very contentious, that you can do to add that kind of pop that makes it a little more exciting.
Thanks a lot for that call. Oh, and speaking of kids, and Deb, you mentioned those beets that you don't like. In my household, my kids are growing up now too, but Dad was the only one who liked to eat beets. Everybody else hated them, but it kind of helped with other foods because, like, if they weren't sure about something, it was like, well, hey, at least it's not beets, right? Can we set up one food as the fall guy to promote other ones, or is that just my strategy? I don't know.
I feel like I do a lot of negotiating. I feel like I do a lot of, like, please just try a bite. You don't have to like it. If you were actually to tune into my table at dinner time, you might hear me saying, could I get you to sniff it? Would you lick the fork that the food used to be on? Parenting is all about dignity.
Yeah. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Deb Perlman of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen, author of the Smitten Kitchen series of books, talking about cooking for picky eaters and how to make the foods we don't like taste good, maybe acquire some taste. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to enjoy foods that you didn't used to like? What worked for you? Do you or have you ever cooked for picky eaters, spouses, children, friends, you name it? Did you find ways to overcome that pickiness? Join in at 800-642-1234. Or was the solution just to make them cook for themselves? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our chat with Deb Perlman, cookbook author, creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's with us today to help cook for the picky eaters in our lives, whether that's someone else or ourselves, and find ways to learn to enjoy the foods we might think we don't like. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience to share or a question maybe about how to appreciate a kind of food that you don't quite appreciate yet? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Juanita is with us in Anawa. Juanita, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Hi. When I was younger, I could not eat potatoes.
there was absolutely no way you could fix a potato that I liked. And I told the lady before, I actually would vomit if I had to eat them. Now I love potatoes. I don't honestly know what changed. But I also know that my firstborn child, when she was little, hated potatoes.
Interesting. So I don't.
Might have been.
Yeah, maybe something genetic. I don't know. Juanita, thanks a lot for the call. Deb, I feel like potatoes are one of those things that, like, I want to give all, like, my kids would just eat all the potatoes. And the tricky thing was getting them to eat the non-potato portions of meals. I don't know if you ran into that, too.
Absolutely. And almost like, wait, does this include french fries or like tater tots? But I also like, it is really funny as like a parent, like spending a lot of time trying to convince your kids to eat things that you absolutely hated as a kid and can't pretend you don't understand where they're coming from. Like you do a lot of that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Juanita. Now, I think a common experience for parents is you want your kids to eat more vegetables. And sometimes you're lucky and they love all the vegetables. Sometimes you don't. Do you have thoughts on expanding the vegetable palate for kids?
All right. So every kid's different. Every kids are different. Every family is different. But sometimes I find my younger, who's definitely the pickier of the two and always has been, she's weird. I was just going to steam broccoli last night and she only wanted it raw. I'm like, all right. Here's your bowl of raw. Sometimes she also, I've seen her like crunch on cauliflower raw, but I cannot get her to eat it cooked. I really don't care how they eat it. If they want to eat it raw, like, you know, it's fine with me. So I tend to, and dinner is always running late in my house. I'm not good at schedules, so I don't like to be rushed. So dinner is always running late, but I'll often just cut up a plate of mixed vegetables, like whatever I have in the fridge, and I'll just kind of like put it between the children, like vegging on the sofa. And I'm always delighted to find that a lot of it's gone when I come back. And it's nice because then we get to dinner time and they've kind of already eaten their vegetables and I don't feel like I have to nudge as much at the table.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Appleton. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I am super interested in this because I have toddlers and I read somewhere in one of those parenting books that it takes 8 to 10 tries for a picky eater to start developing like a taste for the food. And I'm wondering if you found that to be true. And is there any way to shorten the like 10 tries of peas before my kids will eat them?
And Aaron, I want to hear your firsthand experience. Are you at try number 10 on something? Is it working?
For the most part, yes. Yes, I'm at try number 10. My kids now love peas and broccoli, but I still can't get them to eat potatoes, much like your earlier caller. And like things with squishy textures, they just won't do it.
Interesting, Aaron. Thanks a lot for that call. Keep plugging away there. Deb, I don't know if the 8 to 10 rule is going to be true for everyone, but that repeated, hey, give it a try. It worked for me for olives. I don't know. Maybe it'll work for kids.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever counted how many times I've done something. And I'm actually very impressed if anybody gets to 8 and continues trying, because I don't know that I have that in me. But I will say that if I'm really craving something, like my husband and I were discussing this back to the eggplant parmesan, just because it's what's in my kitchen right now. If I'm really craving something, I don't want to deny it to myself just because like I know the children or child is going to nag on it. So I feel like something you can do is just continue to make the food you crave as often as possible. And yes, I might make some plain couscous on the side or figure out some other ways to like get the kid to the table. Maybe I can give them a spoon, some of the tomato sauce over it. Like, you know, we're getting there. Maybe try a little bite. But I feel like when you start denying yourself the things that you really like because other people aren't going to like them, that's when cooking really becomes drudgery and you kind of hate the process and you dread making dinner. And I think nobody wins when that happens. So I feel like fight the good fight if you can.
Thanks a lot for that call and good luck. It's Food Friday. We're getting some help with cooking for picky eaters, whether it's our kids or ourselves. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Deb Perlman is with us from Smitten Kitchen. Back to your calls now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I hate Brussels sprouts, but I keep hearing that if I pan fried them with bacon that I would like them. So I keep wanting to go over to somebody's house who makes them that way to find out if that would change my mind.
Okay, I gotta ask, when was the last time you tried Brussels sprouts?
Well,
a long time.
I get Yeah, it's been a while.
Okay, thank you. I asked.
Seem mushy.
I gotcha. Okay, thanks for the call. Now, Deb, I ask because I've read that the Brussels sprouts people might have grown up with, they're not the same. They've changed some of the varieties. They were built for travel and not for flavor. And Brussels sprouts, and I could vouch for this, they taste better now than they did when I was a kid.
They really do. They're sweeter. They're more like little cabbages, like halfway between greens and cabbages. And they're also, I mean, Brussels sprouts were terrible when we were growing up. I only got them from the freezer, so they were already, like when you defrost a frozen vegetable, it's already mushy. It's not going to get any better with cooking. It's going to get softer. So if you do not like soft, supple Brussels sprouts, you're not going to have liked it very much growing up. But it's changed so much. You've got raw shaved Brussels sprout salads. You've got like ones where they're roasted until they're crispy. I love roasting them with olive oil and a ton of salt until they're almost black on the outside and they're almost creamy inside. They're so good. And yes, you could throw bacon on that cheap pan too, a little drizzle of maple syrup. I think that's why people like Brussels sprouts in a way that they never did when I was a kid.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks a lot for bringing that up, Kay. Jerry joins us now in Manawa. Jerry, hi.
Hi, it's Terry with a G.
Terry, I'm sorry. What did you want to tell us about, Terry?
When I first got married, my wife was a limited eater because her mom was so picky. So we came up with a rule, a two-bite taster bite. And whatever was on your plate, you had to have two bites. And then if you didn't like it after that, fine. Next time, try it again.
Excellent. And did your wife pick up new foods once she was skeptical about, but the two-bite rule helped her out?
Oh, yeah. She's tried all kinds of foods now, and we carried it on to our children. And except for one of them being a vegetarian, they eat quite a wide arrangement of food.
Interesting, Jerry. Thanks a lot for the call. Deb, I did the one-bite rule with my kids. Maybe I should have tried two. What do you think?
I mean, I'm trying to get them to sniff it sometimes. Like, I'm so far behind the ball on this. I'll get them as close as they can. We often do one bite. Sometimes we'll get really belligerent about the one bite when we're like, this is so ridiculous. I know they love this. Like, I know they love this. I cannot, like, sometimes you don't have the patience to, like, indulge it. And honestly, those times, it's surprisingly worked. I won't say that the next time we put it out, they'll remember that they liked it last time, although we try to remind them. But they surprise us sometimes with the things they get really into that they swear they weren't. Oh, just one more thing. I feel like something that doesn't come up a lot is that, you know, the kids, they get snacks in the afternoon, whether you want them to or not. People are always trying to give kids food. or they're, you know, they come home from school or camp and they're really hungry. And I just feel like they often come to the dinner table and they're not as hungry as they should be. And a lot of times when my kids say that they don't like it, they're just not hungry.
Uh-huh.
Like, they might have gotten hungry if it was a plate of french fries, but it wasn't hunger. It was just like nobody turns down french fries, except for those people who called and said they don't like french
fries. Right, yeah. That's a good point. Time for one more caller. Dot is with us in Manitowoc. Dot, hello.
Hi. I suggest reverse psychology. For instance, if your child is 6 years old and you have broccoli, you tell them, don't you dare eat this until you're 7 years old. And then if there's a 7 years old or whatever age that you choose, and perhaps they will indulge on that food or sneak it while you're not looking, they'd say, oh, I'm going to sneak this because my mother said I can't eat this until I'm 7 years old.
And did it actually work, Dot? Did they really do it?
I never thought of it until
too late. Okay.
Many years later. It seems that my children ate what I put on the table because that's all they had to eat.
Excellent. Dot, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Deb, any parting words of advice for people, adult or children, to try something new, even if they're skeptical?
I think that you shouldn't worry too much if somebody's picky. I would say roll with it. Don't lose a lot of sleep over it. I think that most people who grow up picky don't end up being picky adults. I mean, there are exceptions, but it's not all people. And it doesn't mean that they won't be healthy eaters that are curious about food around them. So I think, like, do what you need to do to get by. Try to offer a variety of varied diet, but don't lose any sleep over it. Excellent. I think the kids are going to be okay.
Excellent. Deb, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Deb Perlman, creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's the author of 3 cookbooks. Her latest is called Smitten Kitchen Keepers: New Classics for Your Forever Files. She was with us on Food Friday today to share advice on cooking for picky eaters and finding new ways to enjoy the foods we don't like. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the Ukrainian resistance to Russia's invasion continues with a lot of developments in recent weeks. Catch up on the latest. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a little test for you. Can you name this tune from the garbled audio? I'm hearing two pieces of audio here. I don't know if you are. There we go. All right. There it is. All right. There it is. You can just about make it out. It's a bit from Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall. Why is the sound so weird? Was it recorded underwater? No, it's even stranger than that. It was recorded from people's brains while they listened to the song. As reported in the New York Times science section, researchers played the song for study participants. They were all receiving treatment for epilepsy, so they had electrodes already implanted in their brains to record brain activity. In the experiment, they listened to the Pink Floyd song. Then researchers used the brainwave patterns to recreate what they were hearing. The composite of that was what you just heard. The hope, in the long run, creating expressive devices for people who can't speak. Study just one piece of the puzzle or just one brick in the wall. Music and science news you can use. This is Central Time.